This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. You never know what might result from being a guest on this program. Several years ago, being in that position led one individual to help develop a play, which eventually ran on Broadway and has now opened for a month-long run here in Charlotte, where the idea was born. That guest returns to talk about all of that later in the program. First, something else that was born in Charlotte and which has grown into nothing short of a phenomenon. Elevation Church. In a time of declining attendance at mainline churches here and around the country, Charlotte's Elevation Church is growing fast. In just a few short years, 14,000 people have joined the church and attend services each Sunday at 9 campuses scattered across the region, making Elevation one of the fastest growing churches in the country. Is it because of the rock music that is so much a part of each service? Is it because those services resemble theatrical entertainment or mimic the atmosphere of a rock concert? Or is it because of the message preached by the church's young and charismatic rock star pastor? It's hard to tell, but because Emily Harris is here, she will give us her take on those questions. She wrote the cover story for the latest edition of Charlotte Magazine, On God's Stage, Elevation Church. A former reporter for the Charlotte Observer and the Chicago Tribune, she joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you're very welcome. You know, Elevation Church seems, at least to me, to have come almost full-blown onto the stage here in Charlotte, from absolutely not existing to being this mammoth, influential church with all these satellite campuses. This building in which we sit being one, Spirit Square, is literally taken over all morning on Sunday by Elevation Church. So I'll ask you, for those who don't know, what is Elevation Church and how long has it been around?
The church is about 8 years old, maybe nine now. And what is the church is, a lot of people think it is non-denominational. It is a Southern Baptist church. And it's a mega church in the tradition of what we see, from a lot of other mega churches around the country. It's something, where they do love the loud music, the rock and roll style, and having, services that are heavy on music and heavy on, how Christianity can be healing and uplifting. And some folks view this as more of a kind of self-help view of Christianity, a therapeutic mm-hmm. look.
How does it differ in terms of message, in terms of the way they reach their congregants in from PTL? And I don't mean to use PTL as a pejorative, because I think a lot of faithful people loved PTL, and PTL I think started with, and maybe even ended with, good purpose for being. I don't think that they were crooked necessarily from the beginning, and maybe never. I think maybe they got into some trouble. But they were incredibly influential here and around the country. How do they compare?
Well, I think one of the most interesting differences between the two is a cultural change, which is that PTL was heavily dependent on television, and that's how they reached people. And what Elevation has done incredibly well is figure out how to maximize social media. And if they are, spreading a message about what's going on at the church, if they're inviting people to the church, if they're showing pictures of what's going to the church, they are letting their people who attend Elevation do that for them. And they've done it with incredible effectiveness.
Well, their video presentations that they use on their website, and which I understand they use in their church services, are Hollywood. I mean, they are tremendously well done. They are emotional, moving, positive, uplifting, wonderful in every way. And they use television, but they use it differently than PTL. They use it to transmit Stephen Furtick, who is the head pastor, to all of the satellite locations, including the one in Toronto, because he can only be one place at one time. Why is going to, like, for instance, going to church here at the McGlowan Theater, which seats around 600 people, why is going to church here and watching your pastor on TV a draw?
Well,
when he's in Blakeney.
Right, right. And that's a good question because, of course, the people that are watching him on a screen here at Spirit Square could be watching him on a screen at home on their computer. And I think what draws people, even when they know perfectly well that they're not going to see him live, is what they don't have at home on their couch with their laptop is the energy that is in these rooms. And when I describe in the article that you'll walk in and be handed earplugs,
yes.
or that because it is so dark with, you know, the kind of thumping music and lights, that you are led to your seat by an usher with a flashlight, it is like being in a dance club with, you know, some hot song playing, except for it's 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning, yeah. and the floors are not sticky.
And I've had the sound technicians here at Spirit Square tell me that they set up the audio and they have to leave the theater. It's so loud they can't stand it, and they're mixing the audio. is the loudness? I mean, because you put the earplugs and you feel it. Is that what they're trying to do? You make you feel this experience.
Sure. And that's, you know, they call it a worship experience mm-hmm. instead of a church service. And that's part of their branding. And, you know, when you feel that music, for some people, that's what gets them really pumped up. And you could sort of compare the difference between that and other churches almost with people who say, you know, when I want to exercise, I want to do yoga. I want to take a 40-minute walk through the woods. And other people say, when I want to exercise, I want spin class until, you know, I am just, you know, brutalized and dead. And, you know, you know, they're both exercising, but some people see an exercise as a way to relax and others as a way to get pumped up. And for some people, they want their church to be a moment of, you know, quiet reflection that they haven't had all week. And for others, it's, you know, including people that go to Elevation, it's this shot in the arm.
And it's a whole, I don't know how to say it, quite honestly, but from what I've read from your article and what I've seen here in the building and what I have done when I talk to people who've gone, it's a motivational thing, and they feel good. Having gone, they feel good about their religion. They feel good about God. They feel good about their life, and they become involved. Many of them, not all of them, but many of them become involved in many of the things that the church is involved in, which we'll talk about as we go through this program. And I want to find out why you wanted to do this. You pitched the idea for this story, because you're a freelance writer.
Correct.
To Charlotte Magazine. Why did you want to do this? And I thought, in the course of doing this story, I'm told you went to services at every single location more
yes.
than once.
Yes.
So why did you want to do this?
Well, so my background is being a reporter for newspapers. And so I've always been interested in all sorts of stories. What got me interested in Elevation was, you know, at first, just like many people, I started noticing all these bumper stickers. Mm-hmm. And I see this orange sticker everywhere and has a symbol on it that I don't know what that symbol is. And so you sort of file that away. And then
looks like the little up carrot on your keyboard on your computer in an orange circle.
Exactly. Exactly. A very big part of their branding and church identity. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. the next thing I would notice would be, you know, just scanning the headlines in the morning, you know, that there's a new location here, a new location there, and that they're, it's almost like watching Five Guys, right? All of a sudden, there's a Five Guys burger place everywhere, and you're sort of thinking, how did that happen? And then the final thing was that I saw a photo, and I think it might have been in The Observer, of Pastor Furtick. And he, in that photo, had his hair gelled and spiked up, and he was wearing a very tight-fitting Lacoste shirt, you know, with the little alligator logo, and the collar flipped up and was had a very deep tan and was clearly really young, mm-hmm. you know. And for anybody to get thousands and thousands of fans and millions of dollars when they're really young is amazing. And so that got me curious as to mm-hmm. What is this church that obviously has gotten a lot of power and influence in the city? And for me personally, you know, I'm writing for a mainstream publication, not a Christian publication. So I was less interested in should the Bible be taught this way or the Bible be taught that way, and more interested in their success as an organization, because they have grown incredibly fast, because their branding is so professional.
How do you explain that? Because there are a lot of organizations, churches and others, otherwise, nonprofits and for-profit organizations, who could take a page from their playbook and be very successful. How do they know how to do what they do, which they do very, very well?
That's a great question. A lot of people could take pages from their book. And based on the research that I did and the reading about what we know about megachurches and where they've been successful or not, what I can see is that Elevation clearly took a page themselves from many other successful megachurches. There are megachurches that became successful because they specifically targeted people who weren't interested in church. These are, you know, might be known as a seeker church. And that sort of started in the 70s and 80s, tailoring a church service for people who say, I don't want to go. The next sort of wave that we saw is what we see from Rick Warren, who is considered, you know, the ultimate mega church pastor. And what Rick Warren did incredibly well was figuring out how to use email, how to use relationships with other churches to spread his message and to get lots of other churches reading his books. And so he sort of figured out that. And then the third element we started seeing mostly in the 90s was rebranding Christianity as self-help, as therapeutic, as healing, and as you mentioned before, the sort of place where you can say, Jesus loves me, my life is going to be great, and that feels really good for a lot of people.
Well, let's talk about the theology, because some and evangelical churches, and I would characterize this, am I wrong in calling this an evangelical church?
You're correct.
Okay. Some of them, their theology is a prosperity theology. God wants you to be rich. He wants you to drive that Lexus. What is the theology here?
Well, and that's a great source of debate among folks that either attend Elevation or are church watchers, you know, just watch what's going on in the Christian community. Elevation does not advertise or bill itself as prosperity gospel, mm-hmm. Which is what some churches do. Now, the question is whether, because we see the pastor with the huge house and because the pastor likes to Instagram photos of his designer clothes, whether he is...
And he hangs with some famous people like Steve Smith.
He hangs with famous people, and he likes to mention that he hangs with famous people. So even if, you know, I've heard many, many of his sermons, both by going in person and I listen to hours of old ones that are online, never did he say, God is going to give you a ton of money. But he's obviously gotten a lot of money and enjoys or gets something out of showing that. And so for a lot of people that watch the church, they find it to be a mixed message.
We have an email from Tish on Facebook. Elevation is a cultist church. It is a place for people who want to go to church but do not want a one-on-one relationship with anyone there. Having been to all these churches and all these services, would you agree with that?
That do not want a one-on-one relationship with anyone there. I think that can be a criticism of a lot of megachurches, but something that we see at Elevation and other megachurches is they do emphasize small groups that are meant to be, you know, a group of 10 or 12 where people do have a close-knit community tie and are doing, you know, Bible studies weekly. Now, the question of cultish, that's something else that gets a lot of debate regarding this church. If you look at studies and lists out there from academics as to what makes something a cult. You know, I read those lists and I don't see Elevation meeting that criteria necessarily. Mm-hmm. Now, what gives it, for some people, the whiff of a cult is that so much is focused around Pastor Furtick. And so some people call that a cult of personality and the fact that it involves celebrating him.
Well, we're going to talk about Stephen Furtick in a moment when we come back with Emily Harris, who's the writer of On God's Stage, Elevation Church, the cover story in Charlotte Magazine. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Man Travels, presenting the area's annual travel and cruise show this year on Saturday, February 1st from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Charlotte Convention Center. Details at mantravels.com. Well, in just a few short years, our state's gone from being a conservative rural state to one that leapfrogged its southern neighbors with progressive approaches to education and race relations, growth, and the economy. And now we're in the middle of a politically driven course correction, but in fact, This entire journey back and forth, the pendulum swinging back and forth, has been driven by politics and politicians. Dr. Tom Amon explains all of that whole journey, in his book Southern Democracy, and he will share some of the details tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a federal appeals court strikes down FCC regulations that ensure equal access to the Internet, the debate over net neutrality, and what the decision could mean for consumers and Internet providers.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Emily Harris about Elevation Church, which is a phenomenon in this city. Started just a couple of years ago in the scheme of things and has 14,000 members in 9 campuses. She's written an article about this in Charlotte Magazine this month called On God's Stage, Elevation Church. As you pointed out just before we went to the break, Stephen Furtick seems to be the major reason. He's the lead pastor. It's his church. He started it. And he seems to be the linchpin of all of this. He's the guy. He's the marquee talent, so to speak. He's 33. I've called him a rock star because, and I've only seen him on TV, that's the energy he exudes on television after Saturday Night Live. They carry him on NBC6. It's the vibe that he gives off. There's an energy about him, a likability, a magnetism about him. Have you met or talked with him?
I requested to, and I was not afforded the opportunity to meet him in person or interviewed him. No.
And I have said many times to my producers, get him on. And I don't think we can get him on because I don't think he is generally open to the media. So what? Not everybody has to be on the media. And just because you are on television or a pastor of a church doesn't mean that you're fair game for the media. So I want to put that out there right now. But why not? Why won't he come on? Why wouldn't a pastor come on and talk to you for this major article and spread the word?
Well, an interesting thing that I noticed when working on this, and first off, just as you said, nobody necessarily has to be part of the media. But a big thing that I saw at Elevation is that they like to have total control over the message. And Stephen Furtick likes to have total control over his message and how he's represented, even how he is photographed. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing, because who wouldn't like to completely craft their persona or their image?
I'm on the same page with him.
So on that sense, you can't blame him. What has been mixed for them is at the beginning of the church, they knew incredibly well how to court media attention and wanted a lot because they knew that the media would help them grow. And now they're at the other end of the scale where an outside media report may or may not go the way that they would like it to go. And to a certain extent, they don't really need us anymore.
No, absolutely. No, all they can only be hurt.
Yes.
By us. And what little help we could give them, they really don't need. You're exactly right. You did not speak to him, but you did speak to people who go there and some of the other people who are involved in the management of the church. But how did you find out about all these early facts about his life? For instance, that he got the preaching bug at the age of 16, and he had a job digging graves in a pet cemetery. And while digging those graves, he would listen to his preacher tapes on his Walkman and imitate the cadence of these preachers. What a great way to learn. I'm telling you, this guy's brilliant. What a great way to learn. How did you find that out? And how do you know it's true?
Well, those are two great questions. First, how do we know that it's true? I don't have anybody who is a witness to Stephen listening to these tapes. And, when someone writes about themselves, that's also part of creating an image, even if it's a quote unquote honest representation of what they were doing. Now, as to the question, how do I know all of this? that a lot of these details that are in the story about Stephen growing up or things that happened in his life or approaches that he took are items that he wrote about in his books or talked about in his earlier sermons. And I read both of his books twice, and because there were so many small details in there that were really interesting. Mm-hmm. And what I found compelling about the detail that you just mentioned is the listening to the tapes and the mimicking. And I think that that tells us a lot about him as a student. And one thing I mentioned in the article is that after watching and listening to him, do I think that he is necessarily a natural writer, a natural speaker, gifted in that way? That is not the vibe that I got. But what I did get is that he is a brilliant student, and he knows how to work really hard. And just as you said, to listen to the masters at preaching, these people who are incredibly good, and to learn how to copy their style, their cadence, you know, how to shape the narrative of a sermon so that there's high points and low points and maybe a sad point and then a fist pumping point. I think that a lot of people could study and not necessarily execute it as well as he's learned to execute it.
There's a video on the website of him preaching. I think it was the Easter Sunday service that he did at the Charlotte convention, not the convention center, at the Bobcats Arena, which was full to overflowing. Mm-hmm. And he was making a point, and he takes the microphone, the hand microphone, and starts banging it on the desk to make his point. And that banging is booming throughout the arena. It's very effective. I mean, it really is. You use a former WBTV news reporter and anchor, Tanya Bendixson, as an example of a skeptic turned believer. She, like you, went out to do stories on Elevation Church because of the phenomenon that it is, ended up not renewing her contract at Channel 3 and going to work for Elevation Church. And she said she fell in love with Elevation and Jesus and with what Elevation and Jesus were doing in this city. What did she mean by that?
Well, to a certain degree, she means just what she says by that.
And did you talk to her?
I did. And, you know, and she was very generous and courteous. I joined her at one of the services and also joined her for a dinner and for mm-hmm. a coffee. Mm-hmm. What she told me is what I did hear from a lot of other folks at Elevation, which is that they had had a prior, you know, experience at a church, or that they had already sort of considered themselves a Christian. But it is when they started attending Elevation that they went from like to love, and that all of a sudden their relationship with Christ is incredibly exciting. And specifically that it was Pastor Furtick's, that his way of having a sermon and speaking is what, again, that shot in the arm really pumped them up. And when they talk about what Jesus is doing in the city, is a belief, and this is right on the church's website, they say that what God is doing through our church is unusual. And so what then, you know, for the reader, for anyone to decide is, has Elevation spread so much because that is what God wants, or has Elevation spread so much because they're really well organized and good at what they do?
What's the difference?
Or is it both? Or is it both?
And what's the difference? If you're a believer, if that's what God wants, God will use ways to get you to that point, and one of those ways would be organization. Right?
Yes, yes. And so we hear folks incredibly excited about what the church does. Now, at the same time, that's part of why that sort of whiff of cultish rumor exists, is because people say they love, 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 love that church, and they love their pastor.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the things that they actually do in this city, because what they do is remarkable in many cases. They tutor low-income students. They serve breakfast at the rescue mission. They volunteer at shelters for abused children. They work as literacy coaches to the homeless. They've given away $10 million since their founding to these kinds of enterprises. That's a lot more, I think, I could be wrong, than most other churches.
Yes and no. Yes, in that by doing these great outreach efforts. They're doing what a lot of churches do, which is, you know, filling in these cracks in social services where there are needs that aren't being met. And something that almost any church would want to do or say is that we're trying to serve the needy. Now, when it comes to the money, they have given a huge amount of money away, and that is, you know, you can't criticize that. That is fantastic. What's different is when you look at how much money the church has brought in. You know, if a church brings in $200,000 and they give away 10%, you know, for some people they say that's one thing. Where Elevation gets criticized is even though they've given away millions of dollars into our community, a great thing, is that they've got millions and millions more. And so people say, well, thanks for giving some, but like, what are you doing with the rest of the money?
And that's where the problem comes in. As Laura on Twitter has written, what accountability is there when five fellow megachurch pastors determine Stephen Furtick's salary in complete secrecy? His salary is determined by fellow angelical preachers who I think are on the board over there, and they don't give out that information. And in fact, you write that staff and volunteers have to sign confidentiality contracts which state that they are forbidden to release anything about church finances, including the pastor's salary and anything related to church strategy. Stephen Furtick and other senior church members began forming trusts used to buy their homes to avoid addresses that would be searchable online by using their names. And part of this came up when the Observer reported that he had built a very big home. I think it's a 16,000 square foot home out in the middle of Union County. And he's called that not a very big home, but it's 16,000 square feet and no one knows who paid for it. Is there something wrong with that? Do we as the public have a right to know, a need to know? Do the parishioners have a need to know or a right to know?
Well, and that's what's sort of fascinating about someone who is a pastor and a wealthy pastor is where is the line between public and private figure? He's not an elected government official, but he is this very public person who has a lot of local money. And so what we look for, and I look for as a reporter, are sort of patterns. It's like, okay, so you're going to buy your house with a trust. That really is not that unusual, especially for someone who is wealthy or is a celebrity or famous. You know, I grew up, of course, as you did, with the phone book, where if you wanted to, you'd have to be able to look someone up that way, whereas now you can find out a lot of information about someone's finances through Google. And so you can appreciate why some privacy might be wanted. What happens, though, is that when we see the trust, and then when we see him, you know, when he first addresses the house, really downplay the house, and it's 8,000 square feet.
There's heated been square feet and 8,000 unheated.
Sure,
square
unheated
feet.
For things like, you know, garage and attic. And when we see that even the folks doing these wonderful things that we've talked about, you know, soup kitchen stuff and helping with the tutoring, even those folks have to sign a confidentiality agreement, it does start to look like a pattern of secrecy.
Is that because of what happened here at PTL? They're just protecting themselves from prying eyes? Or is it because it certainly raises red flags. You want to know why the need for secrecy. But in a modern world where, as you say, and these people know it better than anybody else because they use social media very well, in the modern world, everybody knows everything about everything, and that can hinder your progress.
Sure. And it's not unreasonable for anyone to find it sort of strange that, you know, I can look up someone's address and I know how many bathrooms are in their house and what year they bought it.
But they paid for it.
Right. And so so we say, is it secrecy to, prevent litigation? We live in a very, you know, litigious society. And so are they trying to avoid some of the liability if there was a problem at the church? Are they trying to just extend some safety? Or is it because they are concerned that if people knew how much money was really involved, that they would leave the church?
Do we know who owns the house? Does he own the house?
The house was bought through a trust. And
who owns the trust?
The trust is under, you know, it is something that is under him and one of his colleagues at the church. And, you know, does it sound strange? And again, you know, a lot of wealthy people do that with the house. What the trouble that they cause for themselves is how they handled it, of course, by making it kind of a bigger PR debacle than it needed to be.
Well, they give him, the church gives him an undisclosed amount for a housing allowance, and yet they also say that it was money from the sales of his book that are being used to build this house out in Union County. And there's some question about the sales of the book because he donates, I believe, a lot of his books to the church to sell at a profit to raise money for the church. And I guess some of that money goes back for his housing allowance. It seems a little convoluted to the average person who takes home a salary with a W-2, but Stephen Furtick doesn't, and many rich people do not. So is there anything illegal about any of that?
You know, It's not illegal to, of course, buy books, buy a lot of books, and for the church to buy a lot of books where Pastor Furtick then receives royalties and can command an even larger advance. What happens, you know, in, I'm going to use the word, you know, is it feels a little bit like some kind of money laundering, but I don't mean that in the criminal sense of money laundering. What it seems is that, you know, we say, okay, we give this guy a salary, but that house stuff, that's all about his books. Now, the church, though, buys a huge amount of books and can essentially make the book a bestseller. And so that means he's getting a big royalty check due to the money that the church spent and also gets a big advance on his next book.
Some people have said that churches, because they are tax exempt, the property that they own is not taxed. And so when you have a closed system like this where you can't determine who owns the house, is the house being taxed? And when you have nine locations in Charlotte that are not being taxed, and these are big places. These are places that seat 1,600 people and have all this television and lighting equipment that will best any theater company in this town. That's a lot of untaxed stuff that the county could be making money from. So we should, for that reason, we should know. Is that legitimate?
Well, that's a debate that's going on right now. And what we're hearing about, and there's a case going on in Wisconsin right now that's sort of addressing this, which is those rules and laws were originally designed to help out, you know, pastors that really were barely living above the poverty level. And these are, you know, old laws, old rules, and were not necessarily designed or meant to be implemented with what we see today, which is a lot of tax exemption or protection for churches that do have a ton of money. And that's one of the reasons why, at least as journalists, that it is fair to ask questions about the church, because of course it is directly or indirectly supported by a lot of county services.
The followers they're not bothered by this at all?
You know, after my story ran, I heard from a lot of people, and some of them said, you know, especially because we live in a banking town, we live in a finance town, there's people here that really know a lot about money management, and some of those people go to Elevation and said to me, the money stuff leaves me a little bit of a funny feeling. I don't totally like it. I wish that the church would be more open. But what they will also say is that they view some of the mysterious money stuff as either A, nobody's business, or B, a means to an end. With the end being, even if I feel a little funny about some of this financial stuff, the truth is I'm more excited about Christianity than I ever have been in my life. I'm more committed to my family than I ever been in my life. So it is worth it to them.
I've got 15 seconds. What do you hope people take away from this article about which we've only scratched the surface?
I would hope that they would read it with an open mind and to really reflect on how effective marketing can change almost any message, and that includes Christianity. I would have written about a popular restaurant or popular musician, but to really reflect on marketing and social media.
Emily Harris's article on God Stage Elevation Church is the cover story in this month's Charlotte Magazine. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and James McElroy and Deal for over a half a century providing legal services and counsel to individuals and businesses. JMDLaw.com. A federal appeals court strikes down Federal Communications Commission regulations that ensure equal access to the Internet. The debate over net neutrality and what the decision could mean for you, for consumers, and for Internet providers, the topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. When we come back, we're going to revisit a topic in a different way, a topic that spurned a play that is now open in Charlotte after a trip to Broadway because of a charlatan, because of his being on this program. It's very convoluted. We'll find out more in just a moment.
See Theater Charlotte's final rehearsal of the Southern comedy, The Miss Firecracker Contest. It's the story of a woman who hopes winning the local beauty pageant will change her reputation. Go behind the scenes with WFAE on Thursday evening, January 23rd at 7:30. Learn how you can join us at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Matt Olin was once a guest on this program, and the topic that day, if I recall correctly, was Alzheimer's. As I understand this, that experience somehow planted a seed and led to his helping to develop a play about the disease that takes an unconventional approach to storytelling. It literally allows you, the audience, to feel as though you too are slipping into a place where reality is ephemeral. The Other Place eventually ran off and on Broadway and starred Laurie Metcalf and is now opened in Charlotte for a month-long run at Carolina Actors Studio Theater, cast in NoDa. Matt Olin has returned to the show. Who knows what might result from this appearance? A Charlotte native and former managing director and associate producer of Charlotte Repertory Theater, Matt is back to talk about this new play. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you, Mike. Good to see you, too.
You're still tall after all these years.
You're still handsome.
Yeah, thank you, yeah. And we're joined by cast's artistic director, Michael Simmons. Good morning and welcome to you. Welcome
Good morning, back. Mike.
So, Matt, you talk about the intersection of this program. Just stroke my ego. Talk about the intersection of this program.
Here we go. Here
and
we
your,
go.
And your play. You were on the show with a woman who was just in the early stages of Alzheimer's, and she was talking about on that program her experiences up to that point. How did that lead to this play, The Other Place?
Yeah, it was back in 2007. You had you and your team had agreed to do a panel about Alzheimer's, and this was to help promote a charity event that was going to happen at the Mint Museum, where my brother-in-law, Fred Sexton, who was teaching Alzheimer's and dementia patients how to paint, this very therapeutic activity, we were going to auction those pieces off to benefit the Alzheimer's Association of Western Carolina. And this woman was one of the guests on that show of yours. Listening to her story, her sense of identity being thrown into disarray and her courage of facing down that diagnosis sparked something in me, quite frankly. It just got me thinking there's a story here that needs to be told. And of course, coming from the theatrical world, that is the art form that I could see the story being told in. So I very quickly called a longtime friend of mine, Char White, who's a playwright. I've been developing work with him for since the 90s, and I just started regurgitating these ideas to him that this woman's story sparked in me. And what began from there was a 3-year development process where we were deeply collaborative together in creating this story.
Yeah, but let's talk about that, because you didn't write this play, and unlike other productions that you've worked on, you didn't produce this play, you didn't direct the play, you helped develop the play. What does that mean?
Yeah, it's you know, from project to project, it takes on its own life. Mm-hmm. And in this particular case, I sort of conceived of an idea and commissioned a playwright to start writing it, and then served in a sort of a dramaturg capacity, which is a role in the theater that helps essentially shape the development of new work.
Because so you read drafts, yeah, and you say that doesn't work. This might work better. That's what you do.
That's exactly right. Char and I would meet monthly. We had our table at the 42nd Street Oyster Bar in the basement of Grand Central Station. He would basically give me 10 pages. pages at a time, I would go through those pages, and then we would get together and talk. And I would say, this section's working for me. Could we take this section in this direction or that direction? And over the course of those 3 years, a really special piece of theater started to form.
As part of your career, once you I can't remember whether it was before you came here or once you left Charlotte. I know that you worked for some very high-profile Broadway producers, producing some very successful Broadway shows and working with top talent in New York. But you have also done in your career some rather avant-garde pieces. You staged one in a hotel room. You were involved in producing something called Life Game here in Charlotte, which I had a chance to be part of for one night, which was, I thought, brilliantly entertaining and interesting because you incorporated the stories of people in the audience, and not only their stories, but they were in the play. And the play was, because of that, was different every single time it was done. And the actors had to be really nimble to get around this because they were reacting and acting with people who had never been on stage in a story they knew nothing about. And it unfolded before your eyes. How does this play figure into that kind? Because it seems to me to be a little, but what I've read about it, it seems to be a little different in the way it approaches telling this story.
Mm. Well, I would say part of the common DNA for me is my ongoing interest in real-life stories, and that certainly is the case with The Other Place. This was a play that was inspired by a real woman's real-life story, and that was certainly the case with Life Game. You had another person's real-life story being played out, and I find those to be some of the most moving stories that I've ever seen in the theater are ones that are inspired by the real stories of real people. Certainly, as we developed The Other Place, the dramatic structure of it is unconventional in many ways. It does jump around in time and space, and one of our goals really was to give the audience, as you said, a sense of what it might be like to be experiencing Alzheimer's and dementia or cognitive decline. There are specific moments in this play where the audience's perspective literally shifts one way or another, and there is a sense of disorientation than having to sort of reorient yourself to the story.
I think much of that, from what I've read, comes from the fact that Juliana, who is the lead character, this is the woman suffering from Alzheimer's, she's also the narrator, and you find out in very short order, Michael, that she is an unreliable narrator. How so?
I don't know if she's unreliable. I just think it. We're not quite sure when and where she's coming from. And the brilliance of the play is not only does it jump back and forth from place, but it jumps back and forth in time as well. Mm-hmm. And you're never really sure what is real and what is perceived.
In fact, I read somewhere that the audience, and I think this might have been the New York Times review of the Off-Broadway or the Broadway show, I can't remember which, that you feel like as an audience member you want to grab your remote and hit the pause button so you can just think about what just happened, or better yet, rewind it.
Exactly.
And see it again, because maybe you missed something. How does that, is that in the script? Is it in the way you stage it? How is that?
Well, I think it's a combination of both. First of all, it starts in the script because it is so brilliantly written. Matt's the man behind the curtain here, and he's given us quite a lot of liberties with staging. I know when you first presented it off and on Broadway, they did it in a proscenium. We had to find a way to stage it in an arena, in a much more intimate place, and there are a lot of vehicles in the story, such as telephone calls. Well, is this a real telephone call? Is this an imagined telephone call? Are the people that she talks to on the phone there, or are they not there? Is this just a memory or a reconstructed memory?
And as a person, as a director, as an actor, do you know? Is that in the script? Do you know? Or are you as just in the dark as the audience is?
Well, what we like to say is we're not trying to tell anybody anything. We just want to leave you with the same question. What do you think?
How does that impact the performance? Because I guess that leaves a lot up to the mind of the director. It leaves a lot up to the decisions made by actors. And there have been several actors who have played these roles over the last couple of years. And I think there are 20 productions of this right now at any given time around the world. How does that impact the performance? Is it a different play when a different company does it?
Yes, I would argue that it is, and this is one of the beauties of the theatrical art form, is that now that it has its post-New York life here in Charlotte and in, I would say, about 20 other cities, both in North America and internationally, every team is going to assemble their their artists, their talent around this piece and bring their own take on it to their audiences. And that, to me, that's very, very exciting.
Sometimes when you read a play, the author will write a preface to the play saying, telling you certain things about the characters of the play or the action that the audience will not get and that you will not get from the script, so that you will know how he or she intended for the play to go. That's not the case? Yeah.
Well, there are, as we'd say, Easter eggs throughout this script. So as the team, as the cast and the director really sort of dig into the script, there are clues there to be had, but none of them are laid out in incredibly clear ways. It's really meant to be a journey both for the team putting this show on and then subsequently for the audience.
This is the kind of stuff that you, Michael, seem to cut your teeth on, and that cast has made a specialty of over the years. And this is also an example of an NPR driveway moment for you. You were listening to another NPR show, and they did a story about this play New York, and you pulled off the road to take notes.
Which is unusual for me, because I won't pull off the road to go to the bathroom on a 400-mile trip.
So why was it so compelling that you had to take notes?
Well, I think it was so compelling to pull over because not only was I engaged in the interview with Char White and the subject matter, but as I just heard on another NPR show just a few weeks ago, that Alzheimer's and dementia has reached epidemic proportions. Mm-hmm. And what we found through our production is that virtually everyone on our cast, our crew, our staff, our board members, all of us are in some way experiencing the effects either personally or through our families.
Is that because of our aging population, or is something going on here we need to know about right now and stop this interview and do a more important one?
Yeah, I mean, it is very much due in part to this demographic phenomenon happening right now, which is the aging population and more people experiencing dementia and cognitive decline.
Yes, and I think even more importantly, it's always been happening, and maybe we never really studied it well enough, or it wasn't reported on well enough. But I think what's more interesting, and especially for Juliana's character and a lot of what we're experiencing personally, is it's not happening at 90 or 80 or even 70. We're talking about a character that it happens at 52, and in the script she even refers to her the great darkness, as she refers to it, as, well, maybe 10 years ago. Or was it 15, or was it longer?
One of the scariest things about this disease, I suppose, is for the people who have it, because they know they have it, is what's going to happen and the things that – the little signposts along the way that things are happening right now, that things are changing right now. And this play, the way it's written, the way it's staged, allows people in the audience who don't have it to understand the disorientation and the fear that accompanies this disease for the people who do have it and for the families of the people who do have it. What's been the reaction? Because you've been open for about a week now. What's been the reaction of the audience?
The night that Matt was there and we had our big preview, I had never been in a theater that was this quiet before. In the final scene where Juliana is being fed by the woman who she sees as other characters in her subjective realities, it was so quiet, and I took a time for a moment to pull myself out of the director role and just kind of look around and be part of this experience, and it was awesome. It's very powerful.
It's a four-person play. It's Juliana, the woman with the problem, her husband, who is also an oncologist, and then a man and a woman who play multiple roles throughout the play. The play Wit deals with a woman's struggle with, I think, is it brain cancer? With brain cancer. And she literally, at some point in the play toward the end, is stripped naked, literally and figuratively, in front of the audience as a way for you to feel what she's been going through as this patient. How does the other woman deal with that aspect of the patient experience with Alzheimer's?
Well, Matt, maybe you want to go ahead and feel that
The other woman in the play?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, it is a very layered scene. That final scene in the play is incredibly a sensitive, layered scene. And you know, in some ways, as this play resonates with so many people who are experiencing this disease in their family, with their loved ones, we also, I think, connect with that woman who is now connecting in the play with Juliana, and we empathize with her. We feel her confusion. We feel her pain, And we're on that journey with that woman.
This play seems to have been blessed almost from the starting gate, because you had, after you thought the script was ready enough to have a reading, your reading was done by Olympia Dukakis. She played the lead role. And then later in Los Angeles, the lead role was played by Andy Potts, with Alan Arkin as her husband. And then Laurie Metcalf played it off-Broadway and Broadway. She won a Best Performance Off-Broadway Award, an Obie Award for her performance off-Broadway, was nominated for a Tony when she did it on Broadway. And now here you've worked with all these people in all these incarnations, and now here you are in Charlotte. And I know that you only went to one rehearsal, but what's it like to see this performance versus the other performances with these mega people?
Well, to me, it's so exciting. I mean, for starters, I'm a Charlotte boy. This mm-hmm. is a story that was started in Charlotte, and to sort of see it come full circle, and to see this amazing team of Charlotte actors and theatrical talent, mounting this production is in some ways more exciting to me than the incarnations in New York and elsewhere.
What people may or may not know about cast is that you work on these plays for an extraordinary long amount of time, far longer than most companies do, and you, I think you started working on this play before the script was written.
before Matt was born, we started.
So how does that process, because you use a very interesting, deep, in-depth process, how does that work to your advantage for this play?
Well, we got the script 16 weeks out. We finished casting 12 weeks out. We spent 4 weeks of table work just talking about what the script meant, how the characters are connected or purposely disconnected. We did actually look at a couple of the recommendations that were written in the script, which was crisp, tense, impulsive. And we spent just time working on those three words. We were up on our feet at 8 weeks out, and I'd put our cast up with anybody in this country.
So. And Char White, the playwright, I think you hammered home to him that the intelligence of this woman needed to come through loud and clear, that she was intelligent, caustic, funny, and the smartest woman in the room.
And yeah. One who has the cure for dementia.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the irony is, and she has it.
Yes, and she has it. What is she, a bio... Tell me what her profession is.
Yeah, well, she's a medical researcher focusing in this particular realm of Alzheimer's and dementia. And that phrase you said was a key phrase for us throughout our entire development process, which is that you always had to have a sense that she was the smartest person in the room, because mm-hmm. at that point you can really start to unravel her.
Right. Matt Olin is the person who helped develop this play, written by Char White. Michael Sims is the artistic director and the director of this production at CAST. The Other Place is the name of the play. It runs through February. February 1st, nccast.com is a great place to go if you want to get tickets. It's a small house and it's a short play, so you should do two or three performances a night.
Okay.
Get your tickets now. Michael, thank you for being here. Matt, good
thank
to see you.
Thank you.
Thank you.